Case and Cure of a Deserted Soul, Chapter 2. In one sense, the godly are said to be deserted. The second thing follows, how or in what sense the godly are said to be deserted. First, sometimes only in appearance and not in truth. Men are in nothing so much deceived as in themselves. Man's heart and ways, yea, his judgment and thoughts are subject to many variations, and frequent mistakes are found in men's opinions about these great questions. Am I truly changed, or am I a hypocrite? Do I believe or not? Is God my God or not? And so forth. And the errors of men's judgments arise from ignorance, unbelief, passion, false rules of judgment, and so forth, of which principles of error I shall speak hereafter. Through such impediments, men are often puzzled, and they think they are evil when they are good, and worst when best, and furthest from God when nearest to Him. Second, but as desertions are sometimes in appearance only, so sometimes they are real. God truly withdrawing Himself and denying the fullness of communion which His people were accustomed to have with Him. But though He deserts them really, yet not totally, the Lord will not forsake His people for His great name's sake. 1 Samuel 12, verse 22. His truth is engaged in it, for He hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. Hebrews 13, verse 5. The words are emphatical, umi se anu ud omi se in katilipo. Here is to be observed a duplication of the subject of the promise, I will not leave, I will not forsake, and a multiplication of negatives. There are five negatives in the promise by which he intimates that he will not, yea, he will not, surely he will not forsake his servants. He will never completely reject them, nor utterly leave them. To clear this point a little, I will lay down three limitations or distinctions by which we may the better understand in what sense this is a truth that the godly are sometimes forsaken of God. Number one, God leaves them for a season, not forever. If he goes from them, it is but as one that goes from home to return again. I will not leave you comfortless or as orphans, but I will come again, John 14, verse 18. When Zion was in this uncomfortable case, God said to her, for a small moment I have forsaken thee, but with great mercies will I gather thee. In a little wrath have I hid my face from thee for a moment, but with everlasting kindness I will have mercy on thee, saith the Lord my Redeemer. Isaiah 54, verses 7 and 8. He may frown, but he will smile again. Though his compassions may be restrained, yet they cannot be extinguished. His anger endureth but a moment. In his favor is life. Weeping may endure for a night, but in the morning joy comes. Psalm chapter 30, verse 5. In his favor is life, though weeping may endure or lodge as a passenger, to be gone in the morning. But joy comes in the morning as an inhabitant, and enjoys his habitation to himself. As the sun sets to rise again, and as the tender mother lays down her child to take it up again, so desertions are but short interruptions of a Christian's comfort. God will not stay away long when his people cry unto him. He will return and exchange their doleful winter into a joyful spring. Though the river has its ebbings, yet it also has its flowings. The tide of comfort will come in again. There shall be a day of their joyful meeting with their beloved. They shall see their God, enjoy his presence, and be embraced in the arms of his love. And when this day shall come, there will be more joy in meeting than there was grief in parting. God will pour in comforts upon them as they have poured out tears for him, and will recompense their love with kindness, their desires with fullness, their mourning with gladness, their short heaviness with everlasting consolations. Number two, Desertions are not the interruption of God's love, but of the acts of his love. His affection is the same, but the expression is varied. Note that there is a twofold love of God, or a twofold consideration of the same. There is the love of benevolence and the love of beneficence, or as some call it, the love of intention and the love of execution. The former is to the faithful from eternity to eternity, and is immutable, and incapable of any intention, remission, augmentation, diminution, or any alteration. It is like God himself, unchangeable. But the latter, the love of beneficence or of execution, which is his love as it expresses itself in doing good to us, may be in a degree suspended and restrained for a season. As in the summer, there is a lux and lumen, light inherent in the sun and light flowing from it, that is ever perfect and permanent. But this may suffer changes, it may be obscured and lessened, yea, extinguished and quite cut off, as in the night it falls out. A father may have a clear affection to his child, or have a dear affection to his child, yet show but little in his carriage. David shut in his love from Absalom, not ceasing to love him, but forbearing the usual acts and expressions of his love. A fountain may have her streams cut off or dammed up, though it has the same fullness and aptness to pour itself out as before. The root does not always give enough sap to make the branches bud and blossom at all times, yet when she is most sparing in her beneficence, her good will is the same. She sticks as close to them as ever. We often keep back mercies from ourselves when God would more abundantly pour himself in, but we will not open unto him. And so, as that blind woman complained the house was dark when she herself was blind, so we often complain as if God had restrained mercy when we ourselves restrain it. And it is as true that sometimes God is provoked by our sins and keeps in his mercy that he comes not with such gracious visits as before, yet his love is not shortened, though the fruits of it are. Behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, nor his ear heavy that it cannot hear. But your iniquities have separated between you and your God, and your sins have hid, or made him hide, his face from you, that he will not hear. Isaiah 59, verses 1 and 2. Though God may vary in the operations of his love, yet his love in itself is the same, and shall be the same forever. It is an everlasting love. Jeremiah 31, verse 3. The hills may be removed and the mountains may depart, but my kindness shall not depart from thee, neither shall the covenant of my peace be removed, saith the Lord that hath mercy on thee. Isaiah 54, verse 10. This was spoken to the church in her day of sorrow. He tells them he loved them, though he afflicted them, and that speech of God to David is full for his purpose. I will visit their transgressions with rods and their iniquities with stripes. Nevertheless, my loving kindness will I not utterly take from him, nor suffer my faithfulness to fail. My covenant will I not break. Psalm 89, verses 32 through 34. Number 3. When God deserts his people, he only withholds those acts of love that are for our well-being, not those which are for our being. Though a Christian may lack that without which he cannot have peace, yet he will not lack that without which he cannot live. Whatsoever is necessary to his constitution, life, completeness, and stability, these are never denied. No such good thing will God withhold from them that walk uprightly. Psalm 84, verse 11. He will ever hold their souls in life, not leaving them in weak beginnings, but continually leading on unto perfection. As he is the author, so he is the finisher of our faith. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2. We are confident of this very thing, that he that hath begun the good work in you will finish it until the day of Jesus Christ. Philippians chapter 1, verse 6. The saints shall have of him whatsoever is necessary, as without it they cannot hold their state or attain their end, but that which is rather for their ornament than supportment, for the sweetness of their way than the sureness of their end, for comfort rather than necessity, may be and is often in great measure cut off and decayed. This then is the thing when God leaves his people. He does not leave them to the will of the flesh, the temptations and snares of the world, the power and tyranny of the prince of darkness, as never to look after them, but his care is over them in these times, and he is with them by a secret and powerful maintaining, both guiding and upholding them, and is often most in power when least in appearance. The metals that lay deep underground and see not the heavens in their light, yet partake of their influence. Yea, ordinarily, the most precious operations of God's gracious power are there when there is the least sense and feeling of them, and they have the most of God when they see him least. As when God covered Moses, his face in the cleft of the rock, then passed by and gave Moses to see his glory, Exodus chapter 33, verse 22. So the clouds and veils that cover our eyes are often forerunners of the clearest light and sweetest sight of God. And when God seems to be turning a man into a desolate and ruinous heap, yet even then he is building and preparing him to be a more excellent structure. The gardener digs up his garden, pulls up his fences, takes up his plants, and to the eye seems to make a pleasant place into a wasteland. But we know he is about to mend, not to mar, to plant it better and not to destroy it. So God is present even in desertions, and though he seems to annihilate or to reduce his new creation into a confused chaos, yet it is to repair its ruins and to make it more beautiful and strong. The glory of the second temple was greater than the glory of the first. Haggai chapter 2, verse 9. In the repairing of a house, we see how they pull down part after part as if they intend to demolish it, but the end is to make it better. It may be some posts and pillars are removed, but it is only to put in stronger ones. It may be some lights are stopped up, but it is to make room for fairer lights. So though God takes away our props, it is not that we may fall, but that he may settle us in greater strength. He batters down the life of sense to put us upon a life of faith. When he darkens our light that we cannot see, it is but to bring in fuller light, as when the stars shine not, the sun appears, preparing our loss of an obscure light with her clear, bright, shining beams. So then we see that though God does forsake his people, yet not totally, not forever, nor ceasing the affection of love, but the acts, and not those which concern our being, but such as concern our well-being, such as abundant quickenings, and aid of grace, victorious and triumphant power over sin, the clear and satisfying testimony of a spirit, and so forth. Chapter 3. Four other considerations about desertions. Having premised these things in general, I shall now come to the particulars, to speak of these desertions and their several kinds, and first, as they befall the godly. Desertions, as they befall the godly, are of two sorts, the withdrawing of influence of grace and the withdrawing of comfort, inward or outward. All the complaints which the saints do make of God's hiding and withdrawing of himself arise from one or more of these three grounds. Number one, that God does not carry on their spiritual life as he was in the habit of doing. Number two, that he gives not that peace, joy, comfort, and assurance as he had in the past. Number three, that he brings them into outward straits and does not deliver them. Before I come to speak directly and particularly of these, I will propose four brief observations about them. Number one, a man may miss much of God's external presence in the sweet and comfortable way of his providences, providing, protecting, and ordering all occurrence to contentment, yet may enjoy inward communion with him, so that his soul may be most abundantly animated and quickened with the Spirit when he has many discouragements around him. Yea, God usually gives most of himself when he gives least in the world. His people seldom have much of the fatness below and the springs above at once, as the sun and the stars appear not together. But when he shuts up all doors of hope and help in the world, then he sets open the doors of heaven. So Stephen, when he saw nothing but death in the world, then saw heaven opened and Christ sitting at the right hand of God, Acts chapter 7, verse 56. Such mercy found Jacob when he was a poor pilgrim in a strange land. Then he saw that heavenly ladder, and the angels ascending and descending as a pledge of God's care and their readiness for his good, Genesis 28, verse 12. The abundance of the Spirit, both of grace and peace, is usually poured forth in a day of sorrow, as when the dough which the Israelites brought from Egypt was spent, God gave them bread from heaven. And there are two causes of it. A. God's tender love is such that he will not add affliction to his people's sorrow. When therefore he is pleased in his wisdom to pour a cup of affliction into their hands, he usually gives them also the cup of consolation. When he casts them into outward straits, he recompenses it with inward enlargements. The church had never such full predictions of Christ and precious promises of great mercy as when the most dreadful evils hung over her head. This appears in the prophecies of all the prophets. The faithful usually find their worst days to be their best days, and when they meet with troubles, they find most peace. This the apostle witnesses. As the sufferings of Christ abound in us, so our consolation also aboundeth by Christ. 1 Corinthians 1 verse 4. And though the outward man perish, yet our inward man is renewed day by day. 2 Corinthians 4 verse 16. Letter B. The capacity of the soul is widened and enlarged in affliction. Heavenly communion with God is sweetest in an evil day, for in it the soul longs after God, that in him it may find all needs supplied which it lacks in the world. Now the more God stirs up desires of himself, the more the soul is prepared to communion with him, and the more it desires of him. The hungry man eats most, and he that is most thirsty drinks the most. When the life of nature and sense is cut off, the soul seeks life in God, and is much in all endeavors of enjoying God. Now she seeks him in prayer, she inquires for him in the word, and by all means reaches hard after him. So David, when he is in the wilderness, pants and breathes after God. He prays, he cries, his thoughts are with God all the day. Yea, in the night he meditates upon them, and saith he, my soul followeth hard after thee. Psalm 63, verse 8. Number 2. One may lack inward comfort, yet not be deserted in the respect of the influence of grace. The tenor of grace and peace is not the same. A man may lose the sense of grace and yet retain the life of it. Though he that has grace and peace may be more happy, yet he that has grace without peace may be as holy. Yea, and as the clouded summer's sun yields more comfort to the earth than a bright shining winter's sun, so when the soul is most clouded, it may be most quickened when the light of God's favor is hidden, and in that time the quickening heat of the Spirit may abound most. Number 3. He that loses God's quickening presence also loses his comforting presence. Though a man may have grace living and stirring without peace, yet he cannot have peace without the life of grace. Peace and comfort are fruits of the sanctifying Spirit, and as there may be a root without fruit, there cannot be fruit without the root. Though there may be the Spirit quickening and sanctifying without comfort, yet there cannot be true comfort without the quickening of the Spirit. One of these two evils befalls a man from whom God is departed, and to whom the workings of the power of God is denied. Letter A. He falls into a spiritual lethargy. He is as one asleep, whose spirits and senses are bound up, so that he is in the shadow of death, neither hearing nor feeling nor tasting the things of God, and so is bereft of all spiritual joys and comfort. When a man is in a state of deadness, he is dead to all things that are spiritual, and they are as also dead things unto him. The promises which are fountains of life to a living man are as dry and empty cisterns to him. Yea, Christ, heaven, and the love of God, though they are the food, strength, and life of a man in a healthful state, yet they are to the languishing soul as meat to a sick stomach. The glorious things of the gospel are to him as a withered flower, or as a sealed book, and he has no use for them. Letter B. He falls into a spiritual frenzy. Excuse me. In the day of estrangedness of God, a man is often much disquieted. The remembrance of his former blessed days torments his soul with grief. The fears of utter apostasy and irrecoverable declination from God do vex it with fears and horrors. Yea, conscience may pronounce sad judgment upon him, and he may conclude himself to be a hypocrite, an apostate, and one under wrath. In this way, either through insensibleness or unquietness of spirit, he that does not have his former vivacity and vigor of grace cannot have comfort in such a state. Number 4. All these may possibly befall a man at once. He may have outward straits and inward troubles at the same time, and this is the lowest pitch of misery that a believer can fall into. Chapter 4. The Withholding of God's Assisting Grace. The first sort of desertion is in regard of spiritual life and grace, and it is either real, chapters 4 through 29, or in appearance only, chapters 30 through 32. Concerning this malady and sickness of the soul as it is real, I will treat in this order, handling first, the state of the deserted soul, chapter 4. Secondly, the symptoms and consequences, chapters 5 through 13. Thirdly, the causes, chapters 14 through 17. And fourthly, the cure, chapters 18 through 29. First of the state, which may be thus described. We are deserted by God when he suspends or withholds the arbitrary and unusual influence of the Spirit of grace. I'll say that again. We are deserted by God when he suspends or withholds the arbitrary and usual influence of the Spirit of grace. That I may more perspicuously express the thing, I will take this description in pieces and explain it in the parts of it. In the description are two things that require opening, the act and the object. Number one, the act is God's suspending. It is a negative act, a non-giving or putting forth that which was wont to be. It is not the taking of anything from a man which was inherent, but the denying of something that was assistant. It was not a taking out, but also not a putting in. As when a spigot is stopped or turned, there is no diminution of water in the vessel under it, but only no addition. The vessel is not made emptier, but not fuller, or as a child when he is set down out of his father's arms is weaker, yet not by any loss of his personal strength, but by the withdrawing of his father's help. The father does not take away any of the child's ability, but denies his own aid. So God, when he deserts his servants, withdraws himself and his spirit, yet so as that we must conceive it not to be a spoiling of what he had planted in them, but not a conferring of that assisting grace which he was in the habit of giving. This will be a little more clear in the next thing. Number 2. The next thing in the description is the object, or the thing which is withheld from a man in this case, which is the arbitrary or usual influence of the Spirit of grace. Here are three things in the object to be observed. Letter A. It is the influence of the Spirit of grace. The presence of the Spirit is one thing, and the influence is another. There may be the former without the latter. The influence may be abated, but the presence never fails. As the soul in the body is ever equal in her habitation, but not in operation, her power not acting, yet her presence continuing. Let her be. It is the arbitrary influence of the spirit which is suspended. There is a twofold influence of the spirit. First, necessary and constant. Second, arbitrary and inconstant. The necessary influence of the spirit is never denied, and it is that which God affords his people to life, and so to growth. Number one. God is ever present to uphold his saints in life, though diseases may molest them. Yet their feet shall not be moved, they shall not sink. Psalm 66, verse 9. As that hand of power which wrought in the creation works still in the preservation of all things, John 5, verse 17, so the Spirit works still, and by a divine power supports the new creature so that it shall not fall back into its first nothing. David found this hand of God staying him in the midst of all his weaknesses. Nevertheless, I am continually with thee. Thou hast holden me by my right hand. Psalm 73, verse 23 and 17, verse 5. Number 2. So that life being wrought by the Spirit of life never dies, and as the Spirit always works to the conversation of spiritual life, so it is ever working to the growth of grace. A Christian is ever growing. He grows when he seems to himself and others to stand still, or even to decline. Yet in reality, he is always growing, though not apparently, nor equally. As there are seasons in nature, so in grace. Grace has her springs and autumns, but as nature is ever tending to perfection, so grace is ever ripening and increasing. Even in temptations and desertions, when God seems to leave his people, he is about the work, perfecting the new man. As in the pruning of a tree, there seems to be a kind of diminution and destruction, yet the end and issue of it is better growth. And as the weakening of the body by physics seems to tend to death, yet it produces better health and more strength. And as the ball, by falling downward, rises upward, and water in pipes descends to ascend, so the new man, when he seems to decay, is still carried on by the hidden methods of God to increase. The plants are as well profited by the nipping blasts of winter, which cause not only the fruits but the leaves to fall, as by the warm beams of sun in the summer. A Christian is a member of a thriving body, in which there is no atrophy, but a continual issuing of spirits from the head, Ephesians 4, verse 16, Colossians 2, verse 19. Every part supplied by the effectual working of the Spirit of Christ, so that the influence that tends to life and growth is necessary and certain. But there is another influence of the Spirit, which I call arbitrary, which is given and withheld according to the pleasure of God. This is assisting grace, or God's gracious concourse with that habitual grace which he has wrought in his people. I call it arbitrary because, though all grace depends upon and flows from his good pleasure, yet in this God is free. He has more absolutely promised to conserve and increase holiness than to quicken, actuate, and excite that principle of life. This he does with great variations according to his good pleasure, being more mightily present by the working and actual aid of his Spirit to some than to others, yea, more to the same man at some times and in some conditions than in others. Sometimes the same Christian is as a burning and shining light, sometimes as a smoking flax. The Spirit bloweth where it likes, John 3, verse 8. Sometimes he fills the soul with fuller gales, and at other times she is becalmed. A man has more at one time than at another. This assisting grace is to actuate, regulate, and corroborate. Number one, actuating assistance is that by which God carries his people to action and fruitfulness, causing that inward seed which he has sown to bud and bear. God works this first by exciting and blowing up that latent spark of grace in the heart. Grace is an active thing, yet needs to be excited because of the indisposedness of the subject in which it is. as fire, though it is apt to burn and is very active, yet when it is in wet wood, it needs blowing up, because it meets with strong opposition in the subject. Wetness of the wood gives check under the active spirit of the fire. And besides this contrariety in us, in whom the flesh lusts against the spirit, so that without assistance we cannot do the good that we would, Galatians 5, verse 17. There is an external impediment, Satan assaulting with all possible quench coals that he may cast a damp upon the soul. Therefore, we need to be quickened by a continual influence, and this God is pleased to give us to his servants. Jeremiah found this working of the Spirit to quicken and stir up his graces, which began to flag. Impatience and passion began to stifle his zeal and readiness in his ministry. But God came in to help him and blew up the spark. So says he, it was in mine heart as a burning fire shut up in my bones, and I was weary with forbearing as I could not stay. Jeremiah chapter 20, verse 9. When this is denied, there is much deadness, dullness, and slumber in the soul, that a man shall see it is not with him as in former days, when the Lord was more graciously present and assistant to him. Actuating assistance is also that which enables us to act. It is not enough that God has given habitual grace, or that we are excited and come to the bud and blossom of holy desires, dispositions, and resolutions, but we still need the help of his power, that these blossoms fail not, so that we may bring forth the fruit of action as in a tree. There is seminal virtue of bearing, yet except it be helped by the influence of the heavens, it cannot bring forth fruit. It is God that giveth, not only to will, but to do. Philippians chapter 2, verse 13. There is a power of God which worketh in those that believe. Ephesians 1, verse 19, and Colossians 1, verse 18. And a Christian's fruitfulness is according to the working of this power. When God is pleased to put forth his hand to take hold of him, draw him, and enable him, he runs with joy and speed in the ways of God. His affections are inflamed, his heart is prepared, and he is apt to do good and receive good and walks with delight with God. But when God shuts in his usual mercy, then he walks heavily, and now his soul is full of complaints. I would, but I cannot. There are desires and good inclinations, but they do not come to perfection. The soul conceives and travails with purposes and faith. I will look to my ways that I offend not. I will pray more and mourn more and do more, but it lacks the strength to bring forth. Therefore, the godly cry for help, which they would not need if they had a sufficiency in themselves. Number 2. Assisting grace regulates and orders a man in doing good. This is necessary, for often there is much readiness and life and aptness to do good, but yet much failing in the manner of it. Therefore, the same Spirit that directs us in what we should do also teaches us how to do it. How often are the godly in that case that they would eagerly humble their souls and afflict themselves, yet know not how to do it? How often bent to other duties, yet know not how to do them in a spiritual manner. What the apostle says of one duty is true of all. We know not how to pray as we ought, Romans 8, verse 26. Therefore, the Spirit helpeth our infirmities, and by a gracious conduct leads us that we walk aright. As the master guides the hand of a young writer to write according to his copy, and as the father, in leading his child, draws him because he is unwilling, helps him because he is weak, and guides him because he is apt to lose his way, so God is said not only to draw, Song of Solomon 1:4, John 6:44, and to help, Romans 8:26, but to order and direct his people, Psalm 37:23, 119:133, 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 5. A ship may be rigged and have a fitness to sail, but it may still lack a wind to move it or a pilot to guide it. Number 3. Assisting grace will often corroborate and fortify in some imminent difficulty. Suppose a man is mightily assaulted by some strong lust, being presented with the occasion, opportunity, and Satan's strong power. In such a case, God is wont to underprop and shore up the soul with strong aid. How could a bruised reed otherwise stand against such a blast? A father, when he sees his child is likely to be devoured by some ravenous creature, makes supply of the child's weakness by his own strength. The Apostle Paul was in some great temptation. Satan had shot some arrow at him, but God allowed him not to fall, but held him up, that his grace should be sufficient for him. 2 Corinthians 12, verse 9. At another time, Satan took up other weapons, assaulting him with the terrors of troubles and of death. He brought in an emperor against him whose power and majesty he thought might have destroyed him, but God was a pillar of strength to render him not moved. All men left him, but God did not leave him. The Lord stood by me and strengthened me. 2 Timothy 4, verse 17. In afflictions and hard sorrows, this assistance is also wont to be afforded. The same apostle also found God here. He was put to many a hard shift for his living, having passed through nakedness, hunger, thirst, and want, which were able to have broken the heart of man. But the apostle says, I am able to do all things through Christ that strengtheneth me. Philippians 4, verse 13. Thus God is wont to stand by his servants in hard brunts. But when he comes not with supplies and aid, they fail and faint. Temptations overcome them. Distresses overwhelm them. Difficulties daunt them. Thus we see what that arbitrary influence of the Spirit is. But there is another thing to be observed. That desertion is a suspension of the arbitrary influence which we were wont to enjoy. For note, there is a twofold influence or assistance. First, extraordinary. Secondly, ordinary. First, the extraordinary is when in some extraordinary case God comes in with more abundant help, leading the soul in triumph over all assaults, mightily corroborating, not only valiantly to withstand them, but also gloriously to conquer them. This, as it comes upon extraordinary occasion, so it usually ceases with it, and the ceasing of it is not desertion. Second, the ordinary assistance is that which usually a man has in the course of his life. When this is abated and withdrawn, then a man is deserted. A man in this condition is not what he was wont, not so cheerful, ready, and conversant in doing good. When he does not, nor can do as he was wont, at time there has been when he has lived more with God. Now his heart is fallen from the heavenly communion with him. He could formerly mourn bitterly in the remembrance of his sins, but now the heart is frozen and cannot relent. He could have prayed with much affection and holy boldness, but now the heart is cooled, weakened, straitened, indisposed, and so forth. When it fares thus with a man, he is deserted. But here I will add a few advertisements to guide the judgment in this point of God's withdrawing his assistance. Number one, God never denies it wholly or completely to a faithful soul. Though some degrees of divine help may be denied so that the soul languishes in a sort, sinking into a state of deadness and dullness, yet even there is life, and that both habitual and actual. God's clock never stands still, so there is no such deliquium gratiae, no such swoon of the new man in which all acts do cease. It may be so ill with the Christian that he may fall from his first love and the acts of it in a great measure, Revelation chapter 2, verses 4 and 5. But he may be much impaired, that there may seem to be but the remains of what was before, and these remains also may be ready to die, Revelation 3, verses 1 through 2. But God will not quite depart. He will keep the root, and the seed of God shall remain in him, 1 John 3, verse 9. Yea, and the husbandman is ever in some measure dressing and pruning and watering the branches of his vine. John 15, verse 2, Isaiah 27, verse 3. So that though they may bear less fruit sometimes, yet at all times they bear some. A Christian may do less, but still he does something, for though he may lose some help from God, yet not all. If he cannot believe with the fullness of assurance and joy as before, yet he can pray. Or if he cannot pray as he has done, yet he can sigh and groan and mourn. As a spring underground, if it is stopped in one place, it breaks up in another. So the Spirit of grace, if it is stopped in some parts, yet it shows itself in others. Though the sun yield not an equal comfort to the plants, yet a constant comfort, it retires sometimes in part, but never wholly, completely. Yea, God often withholds his quickening virtue from some grace for the perfecting and quickening of another. He sometimes leaves faith in a poor state, much darkened and clouded with unbelief and atheism, in order to raise up fear, awaken to watchfulness, or enrich with spiritual poverty, so that the soul may mourn more seriously and seek more earnestly after God. Sometimes he takes off his hand that held down some present lust and permits it to show itself in monstrous shape and rage, so as to pull down pride and advance humility, and put the soul more to see to be strong in God. Number two, it is not every degree of suspension of assisting grace that lays a man in his former estate as one forsaken of God. But desertion is an eminent abatement of it, so that there is an eminent decay of affection and fruitfulness, and an eminent increase of darkness and lust. A child cannot be said to be forsaken by his father when he lessens somewhat the height and fullness of his maintenance, but when he keeps him from necessary things, allowing him to wander up and down, to go ragged and torn, pinched and wasted with hunger and cold, and does not relieve him, though the sons sue and entreat to pity him. You may say that God has deserted you when he leaves you under the pressures of unbelief and the power of corruption, and even though you cry and call, supplies are restrained, and you are permitted to walk in the valley of the shadow of death. Psalm 23, verse 4. Number 3. Desertion is not to be judged by a partial indisposedness and deadness, but when it is universal. Not all suspension of grace makes this mournful state, for, as I have shown, sometimes God hides himself from one part for the quickening of another, and may be most abundantly present when he seems in great measure departed, as I shall show hereafter. But when a man is overgrown with deadness, which spreads over the whole man, so that he is now less in affection, less in action, yea, unmeet, unwilling, unapt to all good, and the means of good, being abated in all his former life and luster, then he is deserted. There may be indisposedness to some duties from sundry causes, but when a man is less in all, then he is in this woeful state. Number 4. Not every interruption of communion with God, nor every present distemper and indisposedness, argues God to have withdrawn himself. There may be cold blasts, stormy weather, troubled air, and dark clouds in the spring, yea, even in the summer season. A man cannot conclude from some present chilliness or benumbedness of spirit, or from some storms of impetuous lusts, that he is deserted. The deadness of a deserted soul is not transient, but an abiding deadness, not a slumber, but a sleep, not a fit, but a state of spiritual benumbedness. As a mother is not said to forsake her child that goes away and returns quickly, so desertion is not a present sort of, or a present short abatement of God's quickening presence, but may be a continued cessation for some space of time. It may be long.